Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
Beef production up 70 million pounds in 2022, but no change in 2023. Pork production down 60 million based on lighter carcass weights, again, but no change in 2023. Broiler production up a bit based on, again, slaughter pace and heavier weights. We expect to carry into 2023, where we raised the production forecast by about 100 million pounds following the 120 million pound increase for the current calendar year.
World Ag Outlook Board Chair, Dr. Mark Jekinowski.
Turkey production up a little bit in 2022, but down a little bit in 2023, so down about 30 million pounds next year, mainly based on reduced production early in the year, reflecting recent cases of HPAI that would have resulted in some depopulations. So that is expected to be a short-term phenomenon as of right now.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
At some point, the political class needs to start treating the public like adults, tell you the truth, even when it's not what the political class here has said. It's waste and fraud. We don't tax rich people enough. Well, all that's a fraud.
From the floor of the House of Representatives last week, David Schweiker, representative from Arizona.
And going on right now, you got to understand, the numbers are rolling on us. All the trillions and trillions of dollars of stimulus that were pumped into the economy, that set off inflation, that has made almost every American poorer. You got to understand, inflation is higher than wage growth. You are poorer today than you were a year ago. How many members of my brothers and sisters on the other side do you see get behind the microphones and show like they give a damn that America's workers and poor people are poorer today? Well, let's subsidize them more instead of blowing up the economy. And now you start to look at what's going on at this moment. We're already at a $250 billion debt. And remember, our fiscal year began October 1st. And our spending is still exploding. The federal government spent $500 billion last month. And we're supposed to be out of the COVID spending crazy. And we're not. And I bring this chart just as a simple, sort of get our heads around the trajectory. So look, these two lines here, that's the 20 and 21, COVID. You see there are just huge amounts of government spending. But what's important here is you see this line right here. That's just, if you go back to normalize, get rid of these 2 years, just normalize. The debt is just going where everyone has modeled it. And this isn't new. This is being talked about for a quarter century. Does anyone remember when, one of the senior commanders of the U.S. military came here to Congress and testified and said, I believe the greatest threat to the United States long run is our debt. And the spenders around here, no, you can't talk about that. And one of the reasons I believe the public should be just livid with us is our unwillingness to treat them like adults. And the other thing that's going on, back to telling the truth again, 1980s. Does anyone remember the 1980s? Well, apparently, if you did the mean of the interest on U.S. sovereign bonds at that time, we were financing around 10% interest rates. But we had this artificially low interest. Now, killed you if you were a saver. Killed you if you were trying to save for retirement. It was great if you wanted to go into debt. But I need you to look at something here. During 2020s, we had an average of 2.2% was the CBO calculation. They even project that when we go off into the future, we're going to double that. And it's already doubled today. So do we go back to the magic times where, hey, we're around 2%, 2010, 2% for the decade? Or if we double it, and what happens if we double U.S. interest rates? If we go up 2%, 30 years from now, we're at 280% of debt to GDP. Do you know if you go up, I think it was, what was the math, long term? I think it like 25 years, a 2% increase on here basically consumes every projected dollar of tax receipts. It's all our money. How many of you plan to live another 25 years? How many of you really believe we're going back to the age of 2% or less interest on U.S. sovereign debt? How many of you agree with the Congressional Budget Office that because we're going to be borrowing so much of the world's capital to finance our debt, that we're going to push up interest rates for ourselves and the world, and by doing that, we drive ourselves into bankruptcy even faster?
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Look forward to continuing to work towards a solution here that a solution where I don't have to pay overages to Verizon because I'm using my cell phone to link to the internet instead of the AT&T service that I pay for at my home.
Representative Austin Scott from Georgia, member of the House Ag Committee on the Broadband for Rural America Act.
I represent all or part of 24 counties in the state of Georgia. I live on the border of two of those counties, Tifton, Turner, and 15 miles to the north, you have access to high-speed internet, and 15 miles to the south, you have access to high-speed internet. But for those of us who live in between the cities, we have significant challenges with everything from our kids' homework to simply doing a day-to-day bill paying and other things. So the key aspect to me of this piece of legislation that is different from others is what I would refer to as the fast-forward funding. It is the $3.7 billion a year for 2 years that we're going to put into the USDA. I think it's important for rural America that the money goes to the USDA and not to the Federal Communication Commission. There's some talk at the Federal Communication Commission of changing the speed from 25 to 100 megabytes is what people are considered to be high speed. We in rural America want to make sure that we get to that 25 megabytes prior to the expansion to 100. And by putting the money in the USDA, we feel like the focus of the funds will end up being in that expansion to rural America. We're all using more bandwidth today than we have in the past. I think that bandwidth will continue to increase exponentially. And again, that just makes it more important for us to get this done sooner than later. There are provisions in this bill that have been authorized through previous farm bills. One of those is a provision called the middle mile. The middle mile is what I would refer to as the on-ramp, if you will, from rural America to where the high-speed internet actually is. So that provision is in here. The authorization is in here. And as sometimes happens, what we authorize in the farm bill did not get funded through the Appropriations Committee. So hopefully that will get done this time. But again, a lot of work has gone into this. A lot of people deserve a lot of credit. Happy to be a part of what I hope is a great solution for rural America.
But how do you help rural areas actively utilize the programs? Incoming chairman of the House Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson.
You know, we can put forward righteous legislation, have it implemented and converted from legislation into programs where people are not able to, if communities can't access them, then they're all for nothing, right? I mean, it's a part of the what we do, the process. These programs are perfect, though, for being accessed because USDA has a presence in every county. Through our NRCS offices, FSA, even what I would call some of the cousins of USDA, like the our cooperative extensions, which are part of our land grant universities, that would be able to help people navigate. I'm sure that would help make referrals. I would also hope that every community is represented with a member of Congress. And I know that's a role that those of us who serve on the Agriculture Committee we want to be facilitators and help connect. So there's a host of avenues out there to make ultimately to have this access occur in every county in the United States of America.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Whether an advance of funds is a loan or a gift, an ad classification makes a difference, a huge difference from a tax standpoint.
Roger McCowan is a Washburn University tax specialist.
And the IRS does approach this in a particular way, and I think it's helpful to know how they analyze this question. They presume that if you make an advance, that it's a gift when a transfer between family members is involved. So that's the starting point. They're going to presume that it's a gift. Now, you may or may not want that result, and you can overcome that presumption by showing that you've satisfied the number of factors that IRS looks at. One of those is that repayment was actually expected and that you actually intended to enforce the indebtedness. And when the IRS looks at that point, then there are other factors that they analyze to determine whether any particular advance amounts to a loan or a gift.
Talks about multiple children and some of the challenges.
A lot of parents, if they have multiple children, they have a desire to treat all their kids equally. or at least fairly. And that's another topic for another day. Equal doesn't necessarily mean fair. Fair doesn't necessarily mean equal, let me put it that way.
Right.
And that's an important point, particularly when we have in the farm sector, on-farm and off-farm heirs. We don't want to just divide the pie up equally amongst all the kids, some of whom don't have an interest in continuing the farm or the ranch. But that's what she had here. She had five children, and her expressed desire was to treat them all equally upon her death. So she kept a personal record of advances that she had made to each child during life and any repayments that the child had made. And she treated the original advances as loans and forgave that so-called debt account of each child annually in the amount of the federal gift tax present interest annual exclusion. That's that $15,000 amount, at least that's what it is right now, per child, per year. And she and her spouse, so mom and dad, established a trust to hold some of their jointly owned property. And they had a substantial art collection and office building in San Francisco. And when she died, her five children were among the beneficiaries of the trust. Her oldest child ran up against some pretty difficult financial circumstances and entered into an agreement with the trust to use the trust property as security for $600,000 in bank loans. The son also owed the trust back rent from his architecture practice. Dad had been a pretty prominent architect, and the son was trying to follow in his footsteps. Didn't turn out as well for him. He failed to meet the loan obligations. The trust was liable in that instance for the bank loan. And then the decedent transfers over $1 million to the son, to her son, from 85 through 2007. He didn't make any repayments after 1988.
Wow.
And then she also had a revocable trust that she created in 1989, and that specifically excluded him from any distribution from her estate. So it looks to me like, okay, she's thinking that these are advances that he's not going to have to be paying back, so I'm not going to leave him anything in my estate. That's going to go to his siblings. And that trust was later amended to include a formula to account for loans made to the son during her lifetime. That's the way it was categorized. Well, when she dies, another son filed a federal estate tax return for the estate, and the IRS determined a deficiency of about $1.1 to $1.2 million, claiming that the advances to the oldest child were taxable gifts. They were not loans. And the tax court said, yeah, that's right, they were gifts. They went through that multi-factor analysis. And I think based on how I've described this, it seems to be pretty clear that these were gifts. There was no expectation of repayment. That was a key aspect to this. And she didn't have a reasonable expectation of repayment anyway because of the son's financial situation and his employment history. He couldn't pay her back.
Yeah.
And so not only did she not expect it, the son had no ability to pay her back. Those are gifts in that situation. And the estate, mom's estate, had a significant gift tax liability.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
We had a really good convention held it at the Omni in Frisco here in late October. Great lineup of speakers. The meeting was very well attended.
Ben Weinheimer is president and CEO for Texas Cattle Feeders Association.
I think as we've heard a lot of times, folks just glad to get back together and enjoy some friendship and camaraderie with their fellow cattle feeders and other folks in the industry. We heard a lot of good things at the convention. You know, our lineup of speakers, Colin Woodall, Randy Block, Pippa Malgram, Emmett Smith, keynoted the day, late in the day on Monday of our convention.
Says there was some positive news in 2022.
We have really strong beef demand here in the U.S. and globally. Our exports continue to be very strong. We've seen the supply chain stabilize, if you will, as things have kind of equalized amongst the cattle feeders and the packers on supply chain issues and, you know, harvest capacity and so forth. The cattle markets at the same time, you know, have been on a improving path throughout the year. And, you know, all those things have really kind of put the wrap on a year where we have a lot of good things that have happened and a lot of things to be very thankful for. Of course, we can obviously talk about the other side of that, which are some of the challenges that we've dealt with, but those highlighting and starting off with the positive things happening in the cattle feeding industry, you know, really helps with our attitudes and our outlook going forward.
And what's ahead for 2023?
You know, we're going to kind of be living, I guess, with the effects really now more so in 23 as a result of the drought that the ranchers have been dealing with in 21 and 22. You know, that's obviously taken cattle numbers the wrong direction when we actually have a huge opportunity to meet a growing demand for beef. We're just not going to have the cattle and the beef to supply. So, you know, we'll see these reduced cattle numbers going forward. We'll see that decline in per capita beef consumption, not because of the lack of demand, but simply because of our inability to supply it. So that's, you know, that's maybe a bit frustrating, I think, for all of us who would like to see, obviously, consumers enjoy more beef and more consumers adding to that consumer base that's enjoying beef. But the flip side of that is, of course, as those cattle numbers tighten up and that demand remains strong, the economic outlook is on a steady incline in terms of a positive trajectory. If you look at the market graphs, and that's really across the cattle feeding sector, you know, the stocker sector and the cow-calf sector. So those will obviously work in our favor going into 2023, and then we'll just have to continue to see what Mother Nature and the good Lord does to us going forward in terms of precipitation and our ability to grow more grass and, you know, rebuild this herd. As the opportunity presents itself, because the market signal sure enough is going to be there to rebuild the herd as soon as the grass is available.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Looking at graphs like this, you can see lots of wiggles in the data, and so it's particularly difficult to try and determine what are the trend perspectives on productivity growth.
Talking about productivity growth, Dr. Philip Pardee, University of Minnesota's International Science and Technology Center.
To try and distill out whether or not that underlying trend growth has slowed or not. And more importantly, an important question is whether that growth is transitory or a more permanent phenomenon. There's been a difference of opinion amongst economists to whether productivity growth has slowed or not. What we found in these longer run data is something that we had not seen before, and that was that the slowing of this productivity growth was preceded by a surge in the long-run growth of growth rate and productivity.
Dr. Pardee's been looking at the correlation between agriculture and the general economy over time.
The period rates of growth of multi-factor productivity for the non-farm sector and the farm sector, and as you cast your eye down those 10-year period average rates of growth, you can see that they're certainly not constant over time, and that, in fact, there was a surge in non-farm productivity growth that preceded the surge in agricultural or farm productivity growth. You can also see on the two right-hand columns significant changes in the positioning of agriculture vis-a-vis the rest of the economy. We can see at the early part of the last century, agriculture constituted nearly 16% of GDP, and that's now down to about 1%, and also a very dramatic decline in farm labour as a share of total labour in the US economy, from well over a quarter of the economy was engaged directly in farming to now about 1.4%. Not much of a difference in the long-run pattern of farm versus non-farm productivity growth. There's certainly differences for specific periods of time in terms of the relative rates of productivity growth between the farm and the non-farm sector over a more generalised decline in the share of output accounted for by agriculture in the US economy, and certainly a dramatic decline in the share of labour engaged in agriculture vis-a-vis the rest of the economy.
When we consider research and development or R&D spending, it correlates with productivity.
This is in inflation-adjusted terms, so we've actually adjusted these data not for the general inflation rate, but for the actual best estimate of the cost of doing R&D. And you can see a very substantial growth in total public R&D spending up until the late 70s, early 80s, and then a slowing down thereafter, and in fact a reduction or a retreat from investments in real terms, in inflation-adjusted terms, in R&D spending by US agriculture. So we spend now between the state agriculture experiment stations or the land grant universities the USDA about $3.8 billion, which is now substantially less than the private sector investment, which is about $8.7 billion by our estimates. So we can see that we've had this disinvestment in R&D spending going on for some period of time. The trapezoidal and gamma plots on there are actually our estimates of trying to take account of the fact that R&D doesn't have an instant impact on productivity growth, but there are long lags between R&D spending and productivity growth. If we saw a close pattern in terms of the spiking of those R&D stocks vis-a-vis the productivity trends, it would point to R&D being a direct source of the surge slowdown phenomena, which is not something we reveal in these data.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Under the WTO system, the appellate body, which is the appellate level of review within WTO's dispute settlement system, has to have a minimum number of members or jurists to review cases.
John Gilliland is a trade specialist and general counsel for the National Cotton Council. Looks at the WTO.
As of December, the membership appellate body dropped under that minimum number. So now we don't have enough members really procedurally to hear a case. Well, we're in this, as we anticipated, the appellate body is now in ice. We don't have enough members to hear a case. And the effect that that has is to chill the dispute settlement system more generally in the WTO. We don't anticipate any resolution to that situation in the foreseeable time. So we are, as we expected, we're sort of on hold.
So what's ahead for the WTO?
You know, the WTO is one of those high-profile international institutions. You know, when we look at the types of multilateral institutions the United States is a part of, and which the United States has led since World War II. You know, what we refer to as the Bretton Woods system, World Bank, the IMF, and, you know, we think of the United Nations as well, although that's not really part of it's not a trade body. All of these institutions serve to stabilize our global relationships. They stabilize the global trading system by providing a forum and a set of rules that all the countries, for the most part, live up to, and certainly aspire, obligations they aspire to meet, even when it's an imperfect system. That stability that the WTO and these other institutions provides itself is a part of the economic growth that we've become accustomed to enjoying in the 20th and the beginning of the 21st century. When we enter into periods where these institutions themselves seem unstable, when their futures seem uncertain, it injects, of course, uncertainty back into our economy. We have less confidence that the rules we've become accustomed to the standards of behavior we've become accustomed to expecting in our importing countries among our other trading partners, we become less confident about those. They become less confident about us. So that uncertainty itself is like a tax, if you will, on our broader economy. Now, what the effect of that tax is, how much of a negative impact it has on our day-to-day lives, you know, it's hard to measure. Because often we may not see those negative impacts on a day-to-day level. And many times, hopefully, we're able to avoid really the long-term negative impacts. Sometimes a shakeup or a review, a renewed scrutiny, if you will, of these relationships is necessary and can be very healthy. And so I think, you know, those who are wanting a United States to review and reconsider the way it relates to the rest of WTO, they would say this is a part of that healthy shakeup. You know, the broader effects will be good for us in the long term. And then there are those who worry that the uncertainty, the signals that we send are that we are a less reliable partner. That's the stage we're in right now. And where it ends up, we don't know. But I think we should all keep in mind that the WTO and its predecessor, the GATT, these other Bretton Woods institutions, have been a part of the stability of our global economy that has allowed our economy and those of our trading partners to really grow so much over the last several decades.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It was December 31st, 2020, when Mexico's president decreed a ban on imports of U.S. genetically modified corn would take effect by the end of 2024. One Mexican official said last week the ban was being pushed back to the end of 2025, with other possible changes to the plan. Either way, the response from U.S. Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack has been the same.
We have deep concerns about the presidential decree.
Reportedly, the Mexican foreign minister and other Mexican officials are in Washington this week for meetings on the subject. Vilsack told reporters Thursday.
Our hope is that they come and with a recognition of the challenges the decree creates. And the hope is that they come up with a proposal that rectifies the concerns that we have.
That the ban has no basis in science violates conditions of the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Free Trade Agreement. Vilsack said a ban would not just hurt U.S. corn growers, but double the price Mexican cattle producers would have to pay for feed. Gary Crawford, Washington.